and hold on as tight as I can. I come to consciousness light-headed, as if I've returned to my body after long years away. Though I expect soreness, my limbs move easily, and I sit up. Outside, the evening lamps have just been lit. I know I'm in the infirmary, because it's the only place in all of Blackcliff with white walls. The room is empty of everything but the bed in which I lie, a small table, and a plain wooden chair occupied by a dozing Helene. She looks terrible, her face covered in bruises and scratches.
Elias!
Her eyes fly open when she hears me move.
Thank the skies! You've been out for 2 days.
Remind me,
I croak, my throat dry, head aching. Something happened on the cliffs. Something strange. Helene pours me a glass of water from a pitcher on the table.
We were attacked by a Fritz during the second trial, on our way down the cliffs.
One of them cut the rope,
I say, remembering.
But then...
You stuffed me in that niche, but didn't have the sense to hold on to it yourself.
Helene glowers at me, but her hands shake as she gives me the water.
Then you dropped like a lead weight, smacked your head on the way down. You should have died, but that rope between us anchored you. I sang at the top of my lungs until every last ifrit bolted. Then I got you to the desert floor and holed up in a little cave behind some tumbleweeds. Good little fort, actually. Easy to defend.
You had to fight. Again.
The augurs tried to kill us 4 more times. The scorpions were obvious, but the viper almost got you. Then there were whites. Evil little bastards, them. Nothing like the stories. Pain in the ass to kill, too. You have to squash them like bugs. The legionnaires were the worst, though.
Helene goes pale, and the dark humor in her voice fades.
They kept coming. I'd take down 1 or 2, and 4 more would replace them. They'd have rushed me, but the opening to the cave was too narrow.
How many did you kill?
Too many. But it was them or us, so it's hard to feel guilty.
Them or us. I think of the 4 soldiers I killed in the watchtower stairwell. I guess I should be thankful I didn't have to add to that tally.
At dawn, she continues, an augur showed up, ordered the legionnaires to haul you to the infirmary. She said Marcus and Zack were injured too, and that since I was the only one unmarked, I'd won the trial. Then she gave me this.
She pulls back the neck of her tunic to reveal a shimmering, tight-fitting shirt.
Why didn't you tell me you'd won?
Relief floods me. I'd have broken something if Marcus or Zack had taken the victory.
And they gave you a shirt?
Made of living metal, Helene says. Augur forged, like our masks. Turns away all blades, the augur said. Even Ceric steel. Good thing, too. Skies only know what we'll face next.
I shake my head. Wraiths and ifrits and whites. Tribal tales come to life. I never dreamt it possible.
The augurs don't let up, do they?
What do you expect, Elias?
Helene asks quietly.
They're choosing the next emperor. That's no small thing. We need to trust them.
She takes a breath, and her next words come out in a rush.
When I saw you fall, I thought you were dead, and there were so many things I needed to say to you.
She brings her hand hesitantly to my face, her shy eyes speaking an unfamiliar language. Not so unfamiliar, Elias. Lavinia Tenalia looked at you like that, and Ceres Corrin, right before you kissed them. But this is different. This is Helene.
So what? You want to see what it's like. You know you do.
As soon as I think it, I'm disgusted at myself. Helene's not a quick tumble or a knight's indiscretion. She's my best friend. She deserves better.
Elias.
Her voice is slow as a summer breeze, and she bites her lip.
No, don't let her.
I pull my face away, and she snatches her hand back as if from a flame, her cheeks crimson.
Helene.
Don't worry about it.
She shrugs, her tone falsely light.
I guess I'm just happy to see you. Anyway, you never said. How do you feel?
The speed with which she moves on startles me, but I'm so relieved to avoid an awkward conversation that I, too, pretend nothing has happened.
My head hurts. I feel fuzzy. There was this singing. Do you know?
You were probably dreaming.
Aline looks away uncomfortably, and groggy though I might be, I can tell she's hiding something. When the door opens to admit the physician, she jumps from her chair, seemingly relieved at the presence of someone else in the room.
Ah, Vittorius,
the physician says.
Awake at last.
I've never liked him. He's a skeletal, pompous ass who delights in discussing his healing methods while patients writhe in pain. He bustles over and removes the bandage on my leg. My mouth drops open. I expected a bloody wound. But there's nothing left of the injury except a scar that looks weeks old. It tingles when I touch it, but is otherwise free of pain.
A southern poultice, the physician says. Of my own making. I've used it many times, I confess. But with you, I've gotten the formula perfect.
The physician removes the bandage from my head. It's not even blood-stained. A dull ache flares out from behind my ear, and I reach up to feel the ridge of a scar there. If what Helene said was true, this wound should have left me knocked out for weeks. And yet it has healed in days. Miraculous. I contemplate the physician. Too miraculous for this smug bag of bones to have done it on his own. Helene, I note, is pointedly not looking at me.
Did an auger visit?
I ask the physician.
Auger? No. Just myself and the apprentices. And Aquila, of course.
He gives Hel an irritated glance.
Sat in here singing lullabies every chance she got.
The physician pulls a bottle from his pocket.
Bloodroot serum for the pain,
he says. Bloodroot serum. The words trigger something in my mind, but it flits away.
Your fatigues are in the closet,
the physician says.
You're free to go, though I recommend you take it easy. I've told the Commandant she won't be fit for training or watch until tomorrow.
The second the physician leaves, I turn on Helene.
No poultice in the world could heal wounds like this, and yet I didn't get a visit from an auger. Only you.
The wounds must not have been as bad as you thought.
Helene, tell me about your singing.
She opens her mouth, as if to speak, then breaks for the door faster than a whip. Unfortunately for her, I'm expecting it. Her eyes flash when I grab her hand, and I see her weigh her options. Do I fight him? Is it worth it? I wait her out, and she relents, pulling her fingers from mine and sitting back down.
It started in the cave, she says. You kept twitching like you were having a fit of some kind. When I sang to keep the ifrits away, you calmed down. Your color was better. Your head wound stopped bleeding. So I kept singing. I got tired as I did it. Weak, like I had a fever.
Her eyes are panicked.
I don't know what it means. I'd never try to harness the spirits of the dead. I'm no witch, Elias, I swear.
I know that's hell.
Skies, what would my mother make of this? The Black Guard? Nothing good. Marshals believe that supernatural power comes from spirits of the dead, and that only the augurs are possessed by such spirits. Anyone else with even a touch of power would be accused of witchcraft and sentenced to death. The evening's shadows dance across Hel's face, and it reminds me of how she looked when Rowan Goldgale grabbed her and lit her with that strange glow. Mamie Reeler used to tell stories, I say carefully, not wanting to spook Helene. She talked of humans with strange skills that were awoken by contact with the supernatural. Some could harness strength, others could change the weather. A few could even heal with their voices.
Not possible. Only the augurs have true power.
Helene, we fought wraiths and ifrits 2 nights ago. Who's to say what's possible and what isn't? Maybe when that ifrit touched you, it woke something up inside you. Something strange. Helene hands me my fatigues. I've only unsettled her more.
Something inhuman.
Something that probably saved my life. Hel grabs my shoulder, her slim fingers digging into me.
Promise you won't tell anyone, Elias. Let everyone think the physician is a miracle worker. Please. I have to understand this first. If the Commandant knows, she'll tell the Black Guard, and
they'll try to purge it out of you. Our secret, I say. She looks marginally relieved. When we leave the infirmary, I'm greeted by a cheer. Varys, Dex, Tristus, Demetrius, Leander, hooting and banging me on the back.
I knew the bastards wouldn't off you. Calls for celebration. Let's smuggle in a keg.
Back up, Helene says. Let him breathe.
She's interrupted by the thudding of the drums.
All new graduates to Training Field 1 for combat practice immediately.
The message repeats, and groans and eye-rolling abound.
Do us a favor, Elias, Varys says. When you win and become Grand Overlord, get us out of here, will you?
Oi, Helene says. What about me? What if I win?
If you win, then the docks get shut down and we'll never have any fun again,
Leander says, winking at me.
You twit, Leander. I would not shut down the docks,
Helene fumes.
Just because I don't like brothels.
Leander backs away, his hand protecting his nose.
Forgive him, O hallowed aspirant,
Tristus intones, blue eyes sparkling.
Do not strike him down. He is but a poor servant.
Oh, piss off, all of you,
Helene says.
10:30, Elias,
Leander calls as he and the others walk away.
My room. We'll have a proper celebration. Aquila, you could come too. But only if you promise not to break my nose again.
I tell him I won't miss it, and after he and the others leave, Hel hands me a vial.
You almost forgot the bloodroot serum.
Liar!
I realize the source of the niggling feeling I had earlier. I'd promised the slave girl bloodroot 3 days ago. She'll be in terrible pain from her wound. Has she been taking care of it? Has Cook been cleaning it?
Who's liar?
Helene interrupts my thoughts, her voice dangerously serene.
She's no one.
My promise to a scholar slave isn't something Helene will understand.
What else happened while I was at the infirmary? Anything interesting?
Helene throws me a look that says she's allowing me to change the subject.
Resistance ambushed a mask. Damon Cassius, in his house. Pretty gruesome, apparently. His wife found him this morning. No one heard a thing. The bastards are getting bolder. And there's something else.
She drops her voice.
My father's heard a rumor that the Bloodshrike's dead.
I stare at her incredulously.
The Resistance?
Helene shakes her head.
You know that the Emperor's a few weeks away from Serra. At the most. He started to plan his attack on Blackcliff. On us. The aspirants.
Grandfather warned me about this. Still, It's unpleasant to hear.
When the Bloodshrike heard about the attack plans, he tried to resign his post. So Tyus had him executed.
You can't resign as Bloodshrike. You serve until you die. Everyone knows that.
Actually, Aline says, the Bloodshrike can resign, but only if the Emperor agrees to release him from service. It's not commonly known. Father says it's some odd loophole in Empire law. Anyway, if the rumor is true, then the Bloodshrike was a fool to even ask. Tyus isn't going to free his right-hand man right when Jen's Tyre is being shoved out of power.
She looks up at me, expecting a response. But I just stare at her, open-mouthed, because something huge has occurred to me. Something I haven't understood until now.
If you do your duty, the Augur said, you have a chance to break the bonds between you and the Empire forever.
I know how to do it. I know how I'll find my freedom. If I win the trials, I become Emperor. Nothing but death can release the Emperor from his duty to the Empire. But that's not the case for the Bloodshrike.
The Bloodshrike can resign, but only if the Emperor agrees to release him from service.
I'm not supposed to win the trials.
Aline is.
Because if she wins and I become Bloodshrike, then she can set me free. The revelation is like a punch to the gut and flying all at once. The Augur said whoever won two trials first would become Emperor. Marcus and Aline are both up one, which means I have to win the next trial, and Aline has to win the fourth. And sometime between now and then, Marcus and Zack have to die.
Elias?
Yes, I say too loudly.
Sorry.
Hel looks annoyed.
Thinking of Lyra?
The mention of the scholar girl is so incongruous to my thoughts that for a second I'm stunned silent and Helene stiffens.
Well, don't mind me then, she says. Not like I just spent 2 days by your bedside, singing you back to life or anything.
For a second, I don't know what to say. I don't know this Helene. She's acting like an actual girl.
No, Hel, it's not like that. I'm just tired.
Forget it, she says. I have to get to watch. Aspirant Veturius!
A yearling jogs toward me, a note in his hand. I take the note from him, all the while asking Helene to wait. But she ignores me, and, even as I'm trying to explain, she walks away.
Chapter 25 Lyra. Hours after telling Keenan I'd get out of Blackcliff to meet him, I feel like the world's biggest fool. 10th Bell has come and gone. The Commandant dismissed me and retreated to her room an hour ago. She shouldn't emerge until dawn, especially since I spiked her tea with Keb Leaf, a scentless, tasteless herb Pop used to help patients rest. Cook and Izzy are asleep in their quarters. The house is silent as a mausoleum. And still I sit in my room, trying to concoct a way out of this place. I can't just walk past the gate guard so late at night. Bad things happen to slaves foolish enough to do so. Besides which, the risk that the Commandant will hear about my midnight wandering is too great. But I can, I decide, create a distraction and sneak past the guards. I think back to the flames that consumed my house on the night of the raid. Nothing distracts better than fire. So, armed with tinder, flint, and a striker, I slip out of my room. A loose black scarf obscures my face, and my dress, high-necked and long-sleeved, conceals both my slave's cuffs and the Commandant's mark, still scabbed and painful. The servant's corridor is empty. I move silently to the wooden gate leading to Blackcliff's grounds and ease it open. It squeals louder than a gutted pig. I grimace and scurry back to my quarters, waiting for someone to come investigate the noise. When no one does, I creep out of my room. Liar, where are you going? I jump and drop the flint and striker to the ground, barely keeping hold of the tinder. Pleading skies, Issy! Sorry. She picks up the flint and striker, brown eyes widening when she realizes what they are. You're trying to sneak out. I'm not, I say. But she gives me a look that makes me fidget. Fine, I am, but I could help you, she whispers. I know a way out of the school that even the Legionnaires don't patrol. It's too dangerous, Izzy. Right, of course. She retreats, but then stops, small hands twisting together. If you were planning to set a fire and sneak through the front gate while the guards are distracted, it won't work. The Legionnaires will send the oxes to deal with the fire. They never leave a gate unattended. Never. As soon as she says it, I know she's right. I should have realized that fact myself. Can you tell me about this way out? I ask her. It's a hidden trail, she says. A rock path, and a scanty one at that. I'm sorry, but I'd have to show you, which means I'd have to come with you. I don't mind. It's what a friend would do. She says the word friend like it's a secret she wishes she knew. I'm not saying that we're friends, she continues in a rush. I mean, I don't know. I've never really had a friend. She's about to say it, but she looks away, embarrassed. I'm to meet with my handler, Izzy. If you come and the Commandant catches you, she'll punish me. Maybe kill me, I know. But she might do that anyway if I forget to dust her room or if I look her in the eye. Living with the Commandant is like living with the Reaper. And anyway, do you really have a choice? I mean, she looks almost apologetic. How else are you planning to get out of here? Good point. I don't want her to get hurt. I lost Sarah to the Marshals a year ago. I can't bear the thought of another friend suffering at their hands. But I don't want Darren to die, either. Every second I waste is a second he is rotting in prison. And it's not as if I'm forcing her into this. Izzy wants to help. A host of what-ifs parade through my head. I silence them. For Darren. All right, I say to Izzy. This hidden trail. Where does it let out? The docks. Is that where you're going? I shake my head. I have to get into the Scholars' Quarter for the Moon Festival. But I can make my way there from the docks. Izzy nods. This way, Liar. Please don't let her get hurt. She ducks into her room for a cloak, then takes my hand and pulls me to the back of the house.
Chapter 26 Elias. Though the physician excused me from training and watch, my mother doesn't seem to care. A note to me is an order to report to Training Field 2 for hand-to-hand combat. I pocket the bloodroot serum, and will have to wait, and spend the next 2 hours attempting to keep the combat centurion from beating me to a pulp. By the time I change into fresh fatigues and leave the training field, 10th bells come and gone, and I have a party to go to. The boys, and Helene, will be waiting. I shove my hands in my pockets as I walk. I hope Hel loosens up a little. At least enough to forget that she was so irritated with me earlier. If I want her to set me free from the Empire, making sure she doesn't hate me seems like a good first step. My fingers brush up against the bottle of bloodroot in my pocket. You told Liar you'd take it to her, Elias. A voice chides me. Days ago. But I also said I'd join Hel and the boys in the barracks. Hell's already mad at me. If she finds out I'm visiting scholar slave girls in the dead of night, she won't be pleased. I stop and consider. If I'm quick about it, Hel will never know where I've been. The Commandant's house is dark, but I stick to the shadows anyway. The slaves might be in bed, but if my mother's asleep, then I'm a swamp djinn. I prowl around to the servants' entrance, thinking to leave the oil in the kitchen. Then I hear voices.
This hidden trail, where does it let out?
I recognize the speaker's murmur. Liar.
The docks.
That's Izzy, the kitchen slave.
Is that where you're going?
After listening a moment longer, I realize that they're planning to take the treacherous hidden trail out of the school and into Serra. The trail isn't watched, solely because no one is stupid enough to risk sneaking out that way. Demetrius and I tried it without ropes on a dare 6 months ago and nearly broke our necks. The girls will have a hell of a time making it across, and it will be doubly miraculous if they make it back. I start after them, thinking to tell them that the risk isn't worth it, not even for the legendary moon festival. But then the air shifts and freezes me in my tracks. I smell grass and snow.
So,
Helene says from behind me,
that's who Lyra is. A slave.
She shakes her head.
I thought you were better than the others, Elias. I never imagined you would take a slave to your bed.
It's not like that. I wince at how I sound, like a typical bumbling male, denying wrongdoing to his woman. Except Helene's not my woman. Lyra's not.
Do you think I'm stupid? Or blind?
There is something dangerous in Helene's eyes.
I saw how you looked at her. That day when she brought us to the Commandant's house before the trial of courage. Like she was water and you were just dying of thirst.
Hel collects herself.
Doesn't matter. I'm reporting her and her friend to the Commandant right now.
For what? I'm astounded at Helene, at the depths of her anger.
For sneaking out of Blackcliff.
Helene's practically gnashing her teeth.
For defying their master, attempting to attend an illegal festival.
They're just girls, Hel.
They're slaves, Elias. Their only concern is pleasing their master. And in this case, I assure you, their master would not be pleased.
Calm down. I look around, worried someone will hear us. Lyra's a person, Helene. Someone's daughter or sister. If you or I had been born to different parents, we might be in her shoes instead of our own.
What are you saying? That I should feel sorry for the scholars? That I should think of them as equals? We conquered them. We rule them now. It's the way of the world.
Not all conquered people are turned into slaves. In the southern lands, the lake people conquered the fens and brought them into the fold.
What is wrong with you?
Helene stares at me as if I've sprouted another head.
The Empire has rightfully annexed this land. It's our land. We fought for it, died for it, and now we're tasked with keeping it. If doing so means we have to keep the scholars enslaved, so be it. Have a care, Elias. If anyone heard you spouting this trash, the Black Guard would toss you into Koth without a thought. What happened to you wanting to change things?
Her righteousness is getting damn irritating. I thought she was better than this.
That night after graduation, you said you'd improve things for the scholars. I meant better living conditions, not setting them free. Elias, look at what the bastards have been doing. Raiding caravans, killing innocent illustrians in their beds.
You're not actually referring to Damon Cassius as innocent.
He's a mask. The girl's a slave.
Helene snaps.
And the Commandant deserves to know what her slaves are doing. Not telling her is tantamount to aiding and abetting the enemy. I'm turning them in.
No, I say. You're not. My mother's already made her mark on Lyra. She's already gouged out Izzy's eye. I know what she'll do if she learns they snuck out. There won't be enough left to feed the scavengers.
Helene crosses her arms in front of her.
How do you plan to stop me?
That healing power of yours, I say, hating myself for blackmailing her, but knowing it's the only thing that will get her to back down. The Commandant would be mighty interested in that, don't you think?
Helene goes still. In the light of the full moon, the shock and hurt on her masked face hit me like a blow to the chest. She backs away, as if worried that I'll spread my sedition, as if it's a plague.
You're unbelievable, she says. After everything.
She sputters. She's so angry, but then she draws herself up, pulling out the mask that lives at her core. Her voice goes flat, her face expressionless.
I want nothing to do with you, she says. If you want to be a traitor, you're on your own. You stay away from me. In training, at watch, in the trials, just stay away.
Damn it, Elias. I needed to make up with Helene tonight, not antagonize her further.
Hell, come on.
I reach for her arm, but she wants none of it. She throws off my hand and stalks off into the night. I gaze after her, pole-axed.
She doesn't mean it, I tell myself. She just needs to cool down.
By tomorrow she'll be rational. I can explain why I didn't want to turn the girls in. And apologize for blackmailing her with knowledge she trusted me to keep secret. I grimace. Yes, I'll definitely wait until tomorrow. If I approach her now, she'll probably try to geld me. But that still leaves Lyra and Izzy. I stand in the dark, considering.
Mind your own business, Elias, part of me says. Leave the girls to their fate. Go to Leander's party. Get drunk.
Idiot, a second voice says.
Follow the girls and talk them out of this lunacy before they get caught and killed. Go. Now.
I listen to the second voice. I follow.
Chapter 27 Lyra. Izzy and I sneak across the courtyard, our eyes flicking nervously to the windows of the Commandant's rooms. They're dark, which I hope means that for once she's asleep. Tell me, Izzy whispers. You ever climbed a tree? Of course. Then this will be a cinch for you. It's not much different, really. 10 minutes later, I teeter on a 6-inch-wide ledge, hundreds of feet above the dunes, glaring daggers at Izzy. She is skittering along ahead, swinging from rock to rock like a trim blonde monkey. This is not a cinch, I hiss. This is nothing like climbing trees. Izzy peers down at the dunes, speculatively. I didn't realize how high it was. Above us, a heavy yellow moon dominates the star-strewn sky. It's a beautiful summer night, warm without a breath of wind. Since death lurks a misstep away, I can't bring myself to enjoy it. After taking a deep gulp of air, I move another few inches down the path, praying the stone won't crumble beneath my feet. Izzy looks back at me. Not there! Not there! Not... Gah! My foot slips, only to land on solid rock a few inches lower than I expect. Shut it! Izzy flaps a hand at me. You'll wake after school! The cliff is pocked with knobs of jutting rock, some of which deteriorate as soon as I touch them. There is a trail here, but it is more appropriate for squirrels than humans. My foot slips on a particularly crumbly bit of stone, and I hug the cliff face until the vertigo sweeps past. A minute later, I accidentally shove my finger into the home of some angry, sharp-pincered creature, and it scuttles over my hand and arm. I bite my lip to suppress a scream and shake my arm so vigorously that the scabs over my heart open. I hiss at the sudden, searing pain. Come on, Lyra, Izzy calls from ahead of me. Almost there! I force myself forward, trying to ignore the maw of grasping air at my back. When we finally reach a wide patch of solid ground, I nearly kiss the dirt in thankfulness. The river laps calmly at the nearby docks, the masts of dozens of small riverboats bobbing gently up and down like a forest of dancing spears. See, Izzy says, that wasn't so bad. We still have to go back. Izzy doesn't answer. Instead, she looks intensely into the shadows behind me. I turn, searching them with her, listening for anything out of the ordinary. The only sound is of water slapping hull. Sorry, she shakes her head. I thought... Never mind. Lead the way. The docks crawl with laughing drunks and sailors stinking of sweat and salt. The ladies of the night beckon to anyone passing, their eyes like fading coals. Izzy stops to stare, but I pull her after me. We stick to the shadows, trying our best to disappear into the darkness, to catch no one's eye. Soon we leave the docks behind. The further we get into Sarah, the more familiar the streets become, until we climb over a low section of mud brick wall and into the quarter. Home. I never appreciated the smell of the quarter before. Clay and earth and the warmth of animals living close together. I trace my finger through the air, marveling at the whirls of dust dancing in the soft moonlight. Laughter tinkles from nearby, a door slams, a child shouts, and beneath it all, the low murmur of conversation thrums. So different from the silence that weighs on Blackcliff like a death shroud. Home. I want it to be true, but this isn't home. Not anymore. My home was taken from me. My home was burned to the ground. We make our way toward the square at the center of the quarter, where the moon festival is in full swing. I push back my scarf and undo my bun, letting my hair fall loose like all the other young women. Beside me, Izzy's right eye is wide as she takes it all in. I've never seen anything like this, she says. It's beautiful. It's... I take the pins from her fair hair. She puts her hands to her head, blushing, but I pull them down. Just for tonight, I say, or we won't blend in. Come on. Smiles greet us as we make our way through the exuberant crowds. Drinks are offered, salutations exchanged, compliments murmured, sometimes shouted, to Izzy's embarrassment. It is impossible not to think of Darin and how much he loved the festival. 2 years ago, he dressed in his finest clothing and dragged us to the square early. That was when he and Nan still laughed together, when Pop's advice was law, when he had no secrets from me. He brought me stacks of mooncakes, round and yellow like the full moon. He admired the sky lanterns that lit the streets, strung so cleverly that they looked as if they were floating. When the fiddles warbled and the drums thumped, he grabbed Nan and paraded her around the dance stages until she was breathless with laughter. This year's festival is packed, but remembering Darin, I feel wrenchingly alone. I've never thought about all the empty spaces at the Moon Festival, all the places where the disappeared, the dead, and the lost should be. What's happening to my brother in prison while I stand in this joyful crowd? How can I smile or laugh when I know he's suffering? I glance at Izzy, at the wonder and joy on her face, and sigh, pushing away the dark thoughts for her sake. There must be other people here who feel as lonely as I do. Yet no one frowns, or cries, or sulks. They all find reason to smile and laugh. Reason to hope. I spot one of Pop's former patients and make a sharp turn away from her, pulling my scarf back up to shadow my face. The crowd is thick, and it will be easy to lose anyone familiar in the throng. But it's better if I go unrecognized. Lyra? Izzy's voice is small, her touch light on my arm. Now what do we do? Whatever we want, I say. Someone is supposed to find me. Until he does, we watch, dance, eat. We blend in. I eye a nearby cart, manned by a laughing couple and surrounded by a mob of outstretched hands. Izzy, have you ever tasted a mooncake? I cut through the crowd, emerging minutes later with two hot mooncakes dripping with chilled cream. Izzy takes a slow bite, closes her eye, and smiles. We wander to the dance stages, filled with pairs, husbands and wives, fathers and daughters, siblings, friends. I shed the slave's shuffle I've adopted and walk the way I used to, my head straight and my shoulders thrown back. Beneath my dress, my wound stings, but I ignore it. Izzy finishes off her mooncake and stares at mine so intently that I hand it over. We find a bench and watch the dancers for a few minutes until Izzy nudges me. You have an admirer. She gobbles up the last bite of cake. By the musicians? I look over, thinking it must be Keenan, but instead see a young man with a somewhat bemused expression on his face. He seems distantly familiar. Do you know him? Izzy asks. No, I say after considering for a few moments. I don't think so. The young man is tall as a marshal, with broad shoulders and sun-gold arms that gleam in the lantern light. The hard lines of his stomach are visible beneath his hooded vest, even from this distance. The black strap of a pack cuts diagonally across his chest. Though his hood is up, shadowing much of his face, I see high cheekbones, a straight nose, and full lips. His features are arresting, almost illustrian, but his clothes and the dark shine of his eyes mark him as a tribesman. Izzy watches the boy, studying him almost. Are you sure you don't know him? Because he definitely seems to know you. No, I've never seen him before. The boy and I lock eyes, and when he smiles, blood rushes to my cheeks. I look away, but the draw of his stare is powerful, and a moment later, my gaze creeps back. He's still looking at me, arms folded across his chest. A second later, I feel a hand on my shoulder and smell cedar and wind. Lawyer. The beautiful boy by the stage is forgotten as I turn to Keenan. I take in his dark eyes and red hair, not realizing that he's staring back until a few seconds have passed and he clears his throat. Izzy slips a few feet away, eyeing Keenan with interest. I told her that when the resistance showed up, she was to act like she didn't know me. Somehow, I don't think they will appreciate that a fellow slave knows all about my mission. Come on, Keenan says, weaving past the dance stages and between two tents. I follow, and Izzy trails us discreetly and at a distance. You found your way, he adds. It was simple enough. I doubt that, but you managed it. Well done. You look. His eyes search my face and then travel down my body. Such a look from another man would merit a slap, but from Keenan, it's more tribute than insult. There is something different about his usually aloof features. Surprise? Admiration? When I smile tentatively at him, he gives his head a slight shake as if clearing it. Is Sana here? I ask. She's at base. His shoulders are tense, and I can tell he's troubled. She wanted to see you herself, but Mazin didn't want her to come. They had quite a battle over it. Her faction's been pushing for Mazin to get Darren out. But Mazin... He clears his throat and, as if he's said too much, nods tersely to a tent ahead of us. Let's head around back. A white-haired tribal woman sits in front of the tent, peering into a crystal ball as two scholar girls wait to hear what she'll say. Their faces skeptical. On one side of her, a torch juggler has amassed a large crowd, and on the other, a tribal Kihani spins her tails, her voice rising and swooping like a bird in flight. Hurry up. Keenan's sudden brusqueness startles me. He's waiting. When I enter the tent, Mazin stops speaking to the two men flanking him. I recognize them from the cave. They are his other lieutenants, closer to Keenan's age than Mazin's, and possessed of the younger man's taciturn coolness. I stand taller. I won't be intimidated. "Still in one piece?" Mazin says. "Impressive. What have you got for us?" I tell him everything I know about the trials and the Emperor's arrival. I don't reveal how I got the information, and Mazin doesn't ask. When I'm done, even Keenan looks stunned. "The marshals will name the new Emperor in less than 2 weeks," I say. "That's why I told Keenan we had to meet tonight. It wasn't easy to get out of Blackcliff, you know. I only risked it because I knew I had to get you this information. It's not everything you wanted, but surely it's enough to convince you that I'll complete the mission. You can get Darin out now." Mazin's brows furrow, and I rush on. "And I'll stay at Blackcliff as long as you need me to." One of the lieutenants, a stocky, fair-haired man, who I think is called Erin, whispers something in Mazin's ear. Irritation flashes briefly across the older man's eyes. "The death cells aren't like the main prison block, girl," he says. "They're near impenetrable. I expected to have a few weeks to break your brother out, which is why I even agreed to do it. These things take time. Supplies and uniforms need procuring, guards need bribing. Less than 2 weeks? That's nothing." "It's possible," Keenan speaks up from behind me. "Tarik and I were discussing it." "If I want your opinion, or Tarik's," Mazin says, "I'll ask for it." Keenan's lips go thin, and I expect him to retort. But he just nods, and Mazin goes on. "It's not enough time," he muses. "We need to take the whole damn prison. That's not something you can do unless..." He strokes his chin, deep in thought, before nodding. "I have a new mission for you. Find me a way into Blackcliff, a way no one else knows of. Do that, and I'll be able to get your brother out."
"I have a way," relief floods me. "A hidden trail. It's how I came here."
"No," Mazin punctures my elation as quickly as it had ballooned. "We need something different."
"More maneuverable," Erin says.
"By a large group of men." "The catacombs run under Blackcliff," Keenan says to Mazin. "Some of those tunnels must lead to the school."
"Perhaps,"
Mazin clears his throat. "We've searched down there before and found nothing of use. But you, Lyra, will have an advantage, since you'll be looking from within Blackcliff itself." He rests his fists on the table and leans toward me. "We need something soon. A week at most. I'll send Keenan to give you a specific date. Don't miss that meeting."
"I'll find you an entrance," I say. "Izzy will know of something. One of the tunnels beneath Blackcliff must be unguarded. This, finally, is a task I know I can accomplish." "But how will an entrance into Blackcliff help you break Darin out of the death cells?"
"A fair question," Keenan says softly. He meets Mazin's gaze, and I'm surprised at the open hostility in the older man's face.
"I have a plan. That's all that any of you need to know."
Mazin nods at Keenan, who touches my arm and makes for the door of the tent, indicating I should follow. For the first time since the raid, I feel light, as if just maybe I'll be able to accomplish what I set out to do. Outside the tent, the fire thrower is mid-show, and I spot Izzy in the crowd, clapping as the flame lights a night. I am almost giddy with hope until I see Keenan watching the dancers whirl, his brow furrowed. "What's wrong?"
"Will you,
He runs a hand through his hair, and I don't think I've ever seen him so agitated. "Will you honor me with a dance?" I'm not sure what I am expecting him to say, but it isn't that. I manage a nod, and then he's leading me to one of the dance stages.
Across the stage, the tall tribal boy from earlier is dancing with a dainty tribeswoman who has a smile like lightning. The fiddlers begin a swift, tempestuous tune, and Keenan takes my hip in one hand and my fingers in the other. At his touch, my skin comes alive as if warmed by the sun. He's a little stiff, but he knows the steps well enough. "You're not bad at this," I say to him. "Nan taught me all the old dances. I wonder who taught Keenan." "That shocks you," I shrug. "You don't strike me as the dancing type." "I'm not, usually." His dark gaze roams over me, as if he's trying to puzzle something out. "I thought you'd be dead within a week, you know. You surprise me." He finds my eyes. "I'm not used to being surprised." The warmth of his body envelops me like a cocoon. I feel suddenly deliciously breathless. But then he breaks eye contact, his fine features cold. The prickle of rejection tingles unpleasantly across my skin, even as we continue to dance. "He's your handler, liar. That's all. If it makes you feel any better, I thought I'd be dead within a week, too." I smile, and he gives me a quirk of his mouth in return. He holds happiness at bay, I realize. He doesn't trust it. "Do you still think I'm going to fail?" I ask. "I shouldn't have said that." He glances down at me and then quickly away. "But I didn't want to risk the men. Or you." He mutters these words, and I lift my eyebrows in disbelief. "Me?" I say. "You threatened to shove me into a crypt 5 seconds after meeting me." Keenan's neck reddens, and he's still refusing to look at me. "I'm sorry about that. I was a jackass?" I offer helpfully. He smiles in full this time, dazzling and all too brief. When he nods, it's almost shy, but moments later, he's serious again. "When I said you would fail, I was trying to scare you. I didn't want you to go to Blackcliff." "Why?" "Because I knew your father." "No, that's not right." He shakes his head. "Because I owe your father." I stop mid-dance, only picking up again when someone jostles us. Keenan takes that as his cue to continue. "He picked me up off the streets when I was 6. It was winter, and I was begging. Not very successfully, either. I was probably a few hours from dead. Your father brought me to camp, clothed me, fed me. He gave me a bed. A family. I'll never forget his face. Or how he sounded when he asked me to come with him. Like I was doing him a favor, instead of the other way around." I smile. That was my father, all right. "The first time I saw your face in the light, you looked familiar. I couldn't place you, but I knew you. When you told us..." He shrugs. "I don't agree with the old-timers about much," he says. "But I do agree that it's wrong to leave your brother in prison when we can help him, especially since it's our men who put him there. And especially since your parents did more for most of us than we can ever repay them for." "But sending you to Blackcliff," he scowls. "That's poor repayment to your father. I know why Mazin did it. He needed to make both factions happy, and giving you a mission was the best way. But I still don't think it's right." Now I'm the one flushing, because this is the most he's ever spoken to me, and there's a vehemence in his face that's almost too much. "I'm doing my best to survive," I say lightly, "lest you waste away with guilt." "You will survive," Keenan says. "All of the rebels have lost someone. It's why they fight. But you and me, we're the ones who've lost everyone. Everything. We're alike, liar. So, you can trust me when I say that you're strong, whether you know it or not. You'll find that entrance. I know you will." They are the warmest words I've heard in so long. Our eyes lock again, but this time Keenan doesn't look away. The rest of the world fades as we whirl. I say nothing, for the quiet between us is sweet and graceful, and of our own choosing. And though he, too, doesn't speak, his dark eyes smolder, telling me something I don't quite understand. Desire, low and dizzying, unfurls in my stomach. I want to hold this closeness to me as if it's a treasure. I don't want to release it. But then the music stops, and Keenan lets go of me. Get back safe. His words are perfunctory, as if he's speaking to one of his fighters. I feel as if I've been doused with river water. Without another word, he disappears into the crowd. The fiddlers begin a different tune. The dance picks up around me, and like a fool, I stare into the crush, knowing he won't come back, but hoping anyway.
Chapter 28 Elias. Sneaking into the Moon Festival is child's play. I pocket my mask, my face serves as my best disguise, and burgle riding clothes and a pack from a tribal caravan. After that, I break into an apothecary for Willadonna, a physician's staple that, when pressed into an oil, dilates the pupils wide enough for a marshal to pass as a scholar or tribesman for an hour or two. Easy. Moments after putting the Willadonna in, I'm swept into the heart of the festival with a tide of scholars. I count 12 exits and identify 20 potential weapons before I realize what I'm doing and force myself to relax. I pass food stalls and dance stages, jugglers and fire-eaters, acrobats, kihanis, singers and players. Musicians strum ouds and lyres, guided by the jubilant beat of drums. I pull out of the crowds, suddenly disoriented. It's been so long since I've heard drums as music that I instinctively try to translate the beats into orders and find myself bewildered when I cannot. When I finally am able to push the thudding to the back of my head, I'm bowled over by the colours and smells and unadulterated joy around me. Even as a fiver, I never saw anything like this. Not in Marin or the tribal deserts, not even beyond the Empire, where woad-coated barbarians danced beneath starlight for days, as if possessed. A pleasant peacefulness steals over me. No one looks at me with loathing or fear. I don't have to watch my back or keep up the granite exterior. I feel free. For a few minutes, I meander through the crowd, eventually making my way to the dance stages, where I've spotted Lyra and Izzy. The two were surprisingly difficult to follow. While tracking them through the docks, I lost sight of Lyra a few times altogether. But once in the quarter, under the bright lights of the sky lanterns, I find the girls easily. At first, I think to approach them, tell them who I am, and get them back to Blackcliff. But they look like I feel, free, happy. I can't bring myself to ruin it for them, not when their lives are ordinarily so dismal. So instead, I watch. They both wear plain black silk dresses, which, while excellent for sneaking around and keeping slaves' cuffs hidden, don't blend so well into the rainbow plumage of the throng. Izzy has let her blonde hair fall into her face, masking her eye patch surprisingly well. She makes herself small, barely noticeable as she peeks out from the curtain of her hair. Lyra, on the other hand, would be noticeable pretty much anywhere. The high-necked dress she's wearing clings to her body in ways I find painfully unfair. Beneath the light of the sky lanterns, her skin glows the color of warm honey. She holds her head high, the elegance of her neck heightened by the inky fall of her hair. I want to touch that hair, smell it, run my hands through it, wrap it around my wrist, and
Damn it, Vittorius. Get a hold of yourself. Stop staring.